It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What a turbulent week in Iowa politics. Yesterday, the head of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, demanded a re-canvass of the results in the entire state, later backtracking a bit and said only the precincts with reported problems needed to be re-examined. Let's get a sense of where we are by checking in with Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
So we have, what, pretty much 100% of the results counted and in. Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders locked in a dead heat, both roughly 26%. Still the AP unable to declare a winner. What do you make of all this?
Well, the results, as we know, have been delayed. There have been problems with those. The candidates have moved on to New Hampshire, and in part, we're going to expect to see the media do that as well. So, you know, effectively, we have a tie at the top. And this is something that is not really all that problematic when you remember what the caucuses are supposed to be doing, electing those delegates to a county convention that's eventually going to translate into numbers for the national convention. And so wanting exact, precise numbers here, because what the most important number the Democrats report is that state delegate equivalent, there are always going to be some error in these kinds of things. The separation here, you know, between a tenth of a percent, basically, is also something that resembles what happened in 2016. And we need to remember that this nomination process that both parties use is a decentralized process. It's a state-to-state-to-state process. You even throw in the territories there. And so ascribing too much importance to one state's result is problematic, and the media wants always to declare a winner, right? But it's the horse race aspect of campaigns. Who's ahead? Who's behind? And in this instance, I think it's enough to say we have a tie. We're going to see what happens in New Hampshire. We're going to see what happens in Nevada. We're going to see what happens in South Carolina. And that's the way the process is supposed to unfold, in a decentralized way over a period of time.
Now, according to a lot of caucus goers we've spoken with over the last few days, Donna, these new rules, the preference cards, both required by the DNC, seem to be what caused some of the, perhaps most of the confusion at caucus sites. What was the National Party trying to accomplish with these new requirements?
Well, the National Party was trying to get more openness and more transparency. And in part, this was something they did at the behest of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Because, again, remember, the Democrats have always just reported state delegate equivalent. They have not reported the raw numbers. And those things in the translation can get different. So we see right now, as it stands, Bernie Sanders on the first alignment has more votes, but that's going to translate differently on a second alignment. It's going to and that's what we're going to use to translate those state delegate equivalents. And so you can have the ratios being affected in terms of who was there and how that translates into delegates because of rounding, because you can't divide whole people, because that's what a delegate is. And so there was more transparency that was sought here. The Democrats' response to that in the state was to make the process a bit more complicated. They, you know, hope to do this to give us more data, more numbers, that first alignment, second alignment, and then the regular state delegate equivalent, which is really what we want to focus in on, because that's what the end result of a primary or a caucus process is to get those delegates elected to go to eventually the national convention.
And the Iowa Democratic Party chair, Troy Price, has really, his message has been accuracy. And while everyone wants accuracy, we know that, and that's admirable. What does the failure of the party to be able to report a final result in good time mean for the future of Iowa leading off the presidential nominating process?
Well, it certainly is a black mark. We're certainly subject to criticism, sometimes even really pretty simplistic criticisms that, you know, Iowans can't count, so why should they be first? But again, when you have elections decided by really close margins, error can enter into that in terms of making a difference who wins and loses. We always have error in counting things like this. Is that error going to make a difference in who wins and who loses? And that's where the difficulty is coming in this particular election. And that's what Iowa Democrats then have to exemplify or, you know, clarify for people in this process, that they wanted to get presumably the results correct, not fast. And again, at the end of the day, remember where Iowa is in this process. Yes, we're first, but we literally have 41 delegates to the Democratic National Committee. That is 1% of the total delegates that will be going to that at the end of the summer.
Mm-hmm. Could it be, and I know the debate's out there, could caucusing simply while folksy gathering in town halls and gymnasiums simply sow too much confusion?
It could, but again, it doesn't have to. Now, again, the process is what it is, and this is not just about registering support for a candidate, it's electing those delegates, but it's also the party being able to govern itself at the grassroots level. On Monday night, people also elected people to represent their precinct at a county central committee, for example. Platform issues were raised. These are fundamental to a healthy party, and Iowa is a swing state in the general election in part because it is competitive, and that party strength for both the Republicans and the Democrats contribute to that. And that is one of the things that a caucus system can help you with within a state is make for those healthy parties.
Okay. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Always great to have your analysis, Donna. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, by the way. We just heard the Associated Press unable to declare a winner in Iowa's Democratic caucuses on Monday. There's a new episode of Caucus Land that goes over what we actually know about what happened on caucus night. Check that out at iowapublicradio.org. Well, the Iowa Public Radio news team has been very busy recently. There were, of course, the caucuses, the results trickling out over several days, a Senate vote on impeachment, the State of the Union, and yesterday's news conference / victory lap by President Trump. You probably don't know this, but the team that oversees our website embeds every video feed and shares all of IPR and NPR's content to social media consists of two very dedicated and talented colleagues of mine. Lindsay Moon is our digital producer, Matt Searin, our digital manager. And what we've seen on social media over the past few days has caused them concern. They've written about it in a new post at iowapublicradio.org under the headline, "As the Caucus Chaos Continues, How We Use Social Media Matters." They join me now, Lindsay Moon and Matt Searin. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's quickly go to caucus night. Tell us what you saw happening caucus night in the days after that to make you write this piece.
So as we got later into the night and we started to get more and more realization that results weren't coming, we started to see a lot more chatter. We saw a lot of people starting to post very upset. Everyone was going through the emotional response to it. And then immediately we started to see a pivot towards either further inflaming those emotions or also a turn to kind of personal citizen journalism, starting to look and see, can we collect these results ourselves? So we just started to flame the fires and get more and more upset as the night went on, as it became clear that we weren't getting results back.
Mm-hmm. There were also tweets that were going out later in the evening. In this piece at the end, we talk about the fact that there was someone who retweeted NBC from 2008, a note that they sent that Joe Biden was dropping out of the presidential race, which led NBC later to issue a tweet that was sort of a statement that was from an old election. So there was a lot of misinformation going around on social media on Monday night, and that's continued as we've moved through the week.
Now, in your new post at iowapublicradio.org, you warn us about trolls and bots that you were seeing. Tell us quickly, what are trolls and bots?
So a bot is an automated account that's run by a computer. You can think about them like social media robots. They're really good at posting things 24 hours a day and often don't have a human voice to their writing style. It's important to make a distinction between the use of the word troll to talk about people that are trying to incite controversy online and people that operate so-called sock puppet accounts. These are profiles of fictional people that are operated by real people.
Mm-hmm. How can we tell fake from real when it comes to social media, those accounts?
Some are going to be very easy. Some are going to be harder. So there's some kind of core red flags that we'd recommend you look for. The first one, the most obvious one, is going to be, is the account anonymous? Was it just created? Is it just what you would call kind of a shell account? There's just nothing there to tell you who that person is. Mm. Does the profile have a picture of a person and a description of who that person is? Does the description match the image of the person? Are they only talking about politics or a particular issue, or do they seem to be talking about things in a way a regular person would? Are they attacking a political candidate, or are they only attacking one side or one point of view? Are they just repeatedly hitting the same thing over and over? Look at the memes they're sharing. Look at the images they're sharing. Does it all just fit the same thread where they're just talking about one message all the time and everything they're doing? And then does that person seem to be unrealistically attractive? There's this, it's taken from marketing research, basically, that the ones that are most likely to be troll accounts are going to be very beautiful women between about 25 and 35, or military veterans. Those are basic marketing principles. You have an emotional reaction very quickly to those.
One thing in your post I found very interesting, also counterintuitive, it's not the bots and trolls putting out the things you don't agree with that you need to worry about, but they're reinforcing your opinions. How does that work?
So when we started writing this article, I reached out to Darren Linville. He's an associate professor at Clemson University, and his research explores state-sponsored social media disinformation. He's presented about his work to the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, the Department of Homeland Security, and U.S. Army Cyber Command. And one of the things that he said when we asked him what to look for is that one of the largest effects that Russians have had in trying to meddle with social media in the United States is that they've changed how we perceive and engage with each other. So these folks that are trying to sway public opinion are not trying to incite controversy and flame the fire. They're trying to reinforce your beliefs, which is really how you move people along a scale.
Make you more extreme is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yep. And so he says it's important when you're interacting with people on social media right now to recognize that one of the things that those accounts are doing is they're shifting our perspectives. And so now when people disagree with us online, instead of responding to them, we have a tendency to think that they're not even real people. And so I think that you could argue that the true spirit of the Iowa caucuses is to be able to get into a room with other people and have civil conversations about people who maybe disagree with you and be able to engage and understand their viewpoint. And so as we've become more alarmed about fake news, disinformation, bots and trolls on the internet, we have a tendency to just write people off if they don't agree with our viewpoint. And so one of the reasons that we wanted to write this piece is to put it out into the world to be watching for people that are just really agreeing with you, because that's how these foreign actors are really trying to sway public opinion.
In the few seconds we have left, of course, the caucuses behind us, sort of, 10 months in the future, we have the general election. Give us some quick advice for our listeners about social media in the coming days as we count down the 10 months to the general election.
I would say be cautious. The first thing is be aware, educate yourself as much as possible on things to look for so that you are careful. You're careful in who you're engaging with. Be careful what you put out there too. It does not take much for someone to take the words that you say, pull them out of context, turn them into something else in order to inflame emotions and to drive this wedge to pulling us further apart. And then the third one I'd have is take a break. Be sure to step away from it. It's too much to try to drink from that stream all the time. Step
Hallelujah.
Away.
Hallelujah to that, Matt.
Yeah. The news is polarizing right now. It's also really important to share factual and current information. We mentioned that NBC tweet that got sent out on Monday that was from 2008. That got tweeted hundreds of times before it was caught that it was from an old election. So check the datelines on the stories and check for when the stories were last updated and make sure that the information that you're sharing is from reputable news organizations. This story is moving very quickly and you want to make sure that the information that you're sharing is from organizations that have editorial boards and have a reputation for doing the fact checking that's necessary right now.
And do check out the new post by Lindsay Moon and Matt Searin at iowapublicradio.org. All the things we've been talking about and more. The headline you need to look for as the caucus chaos continues, how we use social media matters. Lindsay, Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, within weeks of news focused on the caucus and also the impeachment trial, we've been neglecting you on this show as far as what's been happening in the Iowa legislature for the first month of its 2020 session. Let's catch up with IPR's state government reporter, Katarina Sestarek. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's start off with what we're going to devote the show to on Monday, education. What's been debated in the legislature?
Well, Republicans are trying to come to a deal on education funding. That's one of the first things they try to get done within the first month of the session, usually. And right now, House Republicans want a 2.5% increase to across-the-board K-12 education funding, and Senate Republicans want a 2.1% increase, so that's a difference about $20 million. So right now, since Republicans control the State House, they're kind of in a negotiating phase trying to figure out what they're going to move forward with. But right now, They are looking at potentially voting in the full House chamber as early as Monday on their education funding bill. And of course, you have Democrats saying, well, we really need 3% education funding increase, and some education advocates saying that you really need closer to 4%.
Mm-hmm. And again, Katarina, you and I will be co-hosting River to River on Monday, talking about K-12 education funding. Please call in with your questions during that hour. Let's talk about the legislation advancing concerning abortion. Tell us about that.
So this week, a House panel of three House members advanced a potential constitutional amendment. It would change the Iowa Constitution to say that it does not protect abortion rights. This is a response to a 2018 Iowa Supreme Court ruling that said abortion is protected as a fundamental right in Iowa. And it's kind of this. So it was proposed first last year in the Senate, and they had advanced it there. And so it's significant that it's now also moving in the House. It's moving through both chambers, which means it has, you know, quite a bit of momentum right now. But of course, it's a long process to amend the Iowa Constitution. So even if both the House and Senate pass it this year, they would have to pass it again next year or the following year, and then it would go to a vote of the people.
Mm-hmm. And opponents there at the State House have been saying what?
They've been saying that, you know, while some supporters of this say that it's neutral and it just puts power back in the hands of the people to elect lawmakers who will decide what abortion laws get put into place, opponents say that abortion rights have been constitutionally protected for decades and that this change would open the door to more abortion restrictions in the state. And if Roe v. Wade is eventually overturned at the federal level, could open the door to even more, going even further with abortion restrictions than ever before.
Katarina, a couple of other things on the docket there for us to talk about, at least. Work on flood funding has been debated. Tell us about that.
Yesterday, the Senate approved $20 million for flood recovery funding from the 2019 floods that hit eastern and western Iowa. And the House is expected to also approve that funding early next week. So that is for the current fiscal year and would bring the total in direct state funding for flood relief to $35 million because lawmakers did allocate some at the end of the previous session. And so there are some Democrats who are saying that it's not enough money because there's an estimated state funding need of more than $100 million for flood relief projects. But Republicans are saying that they're kind of following the lead of the governor and the Emergency Management Department. These are immediate needs that they're filling, and they don't want to jeopardize potential federal money. So they'll consider more funding in the future, is what Republicans are saying.
And I understand Governor Reynolds' workforce bill is getting its first hearing. Remind us what that's about and why this is significant.
So she's been working on workforce things throughout her tenure as governor, but this would kind of add to her existing Future Ready Iowa programs. It would create a child care challenge program, encouraging organizations to establish child care facilities. It would fund some more work-based learning coordinators for schools. And so a lot of people are really supportive of this. But one of the concerns was about a requirement for all schools to have computer science instruction. There were some concerns about funding and rural schools especially, and that the current offerings, because education advocates say about two-thirds of schools already have some kind of computer science class, but that maybe those don't necessarily live up to the standards set out in this bill, so schools would have to change things.
Catching us up on what's been happening in the Iowa legislature, IPR state government reporter Katarina Sestarik. Thanks, Katarina.
Thanks, Ben.
It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Department of Public Health said this week it's testing two Iowans for the coronavirus. Now, that's the virus that originated in Wuhan, China. It has sickened more than 31,000 worldwide. Dr. Caitlin Pedotti, medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health and state epidemiologist, said on Wednesday that the two were in isolation, being tested at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is news that comes after the University of Iowa vice president told the Iowa Board of Regents that the UI Hospitals is monitoring seven recent travelers to China. Dr. Pedotti joins us now with the latest. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Pedotti.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about these cases that are in isolation. Have we confirmed coronavirus?
You know, that testing that's being done down at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention takes several days. So we don't yet have those results back. And when we do and are able to share them, we'll be doing that. And we've also set up updates on our webpage at the Iowa Department of Public Health to help provide information on that. And you'll see those updates come through every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday so that the public can stay up to date by visiting us there.
Mm-hmm. Do we expect that we would know by next week about these two cases?
I think that what we're told from the CDC is that we should have some information early next week. And again, you know, we'll certainly be sharing that as soon as we're able. And I also think it's important to know that the CDC, along with other national partners, have been working to make this testing capability available to states. So we work very closely with our state hygienic laboratory, and we also hope that within, you know, a week or two, we'll be able to start to do some of that testing at the state level.
Mm-hmm. So far, no confirmation of coronavirus in Iowa. What happens if those two people being tested are confirmed with a virus? What steps would be taken here in Iowa to prevent the spread?
Yeah, so we approach this sort of thing very similar to how we approach many other infectious diseases, including things like measles. And so what we do is ask people to stay away from other people, other settings where organisms like this could move from one person to another. And we check in with them on a regular basis, you know, to monitor their health. And again, that's roughly the approach we take with many kinds of infectious diseases.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got just over a minute left. What do we know about the 7 recent travelers to China being monitored at the UI hospitals?
Yeah, you know, I can't provide any specific details for you about that. That might be better directed, you know, over to the University of Iowa. But I can tell you, you know, that we are working very closely with a lot of our partners throughout the state, you know, to provide support and monitoring to people who have had recent travel. And when we say monitoring, we're talking about checking in on somebody's health to see how they're doing and see if they're developing symptoms that we would want to follow up on. And those kinds of measures are really sort of classic public health tools that, again, we use in a variety of settings. And the goal is to help provide support for an individual and their well-being as much as it is to help prevent these kinds of illnesses from spreading.
We have less than 30 seconds, but generally, how concerned should Iowans be about the coronavirus? A lot of media attention there. Is the concern there to match on your part?
Yeah, you know, anytime we have a new virus that's able to make people sick, this is a serious public health concern. But even though we've detected cases in the United States, and we may find more, we want people to know that the overall risk here does remain low. And for people to stay informed, they should continue to visit us at our webpage and can always reach out to clinical and public health professionals with questions.
Okay, visit the webpage of the Iowa Public Department of Public Health. That's the state epidemiologist, Dr. Caitlin Padotti. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's News Buzz Edition. Back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer.
It's a News Buzz Edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, depending on where you live in the state, depending on what sector you work in, this may come as a surprise. When it comes to economic growth, Iowa is one of the worst performing states in the country. Let's talk more about Iowa's economic performance over the past decade since the Great Recession with ISU economist Dave Swenson. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to our program.
Hello.
So your study is, as I understand, a comprehensive overview of how Iowa, its various industries, its rural and urban areas have fared since the Great Recession of about a decade ago. We had the first inklings, the first start of that in 2007. I wonder if you can start our conversation by having you recount what the national, the world, and our state economy experienced beginning in 2007.
Sure. Well, beginning in 2007, we didn't really know we were in recession. It was well into 2008 when the banking sector, the housing sectors, those all started to show very, very serious signs of stress. That started to ripple out not just into the national economy, but also into the world economy. By after the halfway point of 2008, well into the fall, we knew that the financial sector was in trouble. President Bush at that time, Congress, were having to enact corrective legislation trying to stabilize the financial sector. And we were just then getting a sense of how bad this recession might be. Now, it was still several months before the full brunt of the recession starts to be felt. And President Obama then, coming into office in January 2009, really inherited the worst of the recession. We'd already been through much of the financial crisis, but we had massive unemployment. We had a contraction in the national economy that was relatively strong. We had about 5.5% fewer jobs by 2010 than we had before the recession. That's at the national level. And we had to do a lot of things nationally to stabilize the economy. They had we had a stimulus program. We had broadening of assistance to families, extension of unemployment, all of these things designed to maintain consumption, stabilize the economy, and give the economy time to shake out a lot of the problems that it was having to deal with over that during that recessionary period. And remember, the recessionary period was primarily a housing bubble slash financial bubble. Then all of that had to sort out before we could start growing again.
Okay, that was the big picture. Thanks for reminding us. Let's zoom in now on how Iowa experienced the Great Recession.
Iowa was lucky. Iowa went into the recession a little later than the nation did. It didn't contract as much as the United States average did, and it started to recover sooner. As a matter of fact, Iowa recovered all of its lost jobs by March of 2013. The U.S. hadn't recovered all of its lost jobs until March of 2014. So in the early parts of the recession and then into the recovery, Iowa did relatively well. And Iowa was really lucky at this time, if anybody could have been lucky. Iowa was ground zero for ethanol plant development between 2006 and 2010. We were still building wind energy facilities relatively sharply and all across the state. So there was still strong demand for labor within the state, and a lot of that demand for labor paid well. We added a couple of huge fertilizer plants, and then later on we added more and more of these large data centers. So we had a lot of capital development over this period of time that was able to utilize the state's construction industry, and that helped us not decline quite as far. Also, Iowa's farmers were receiving, after the worst of the initial parts of the Great Recession, ag prices went up. And so as we're moving into recovery, Iowa farmers really led that recovery, at least in rural areas, in the sense that they had relatively strong income growth.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, what is this latest study that you've done, and what did you look at specifically?
Sure. What we did with this study was we're looking at how did Iowa fare over the course of this last decade, but we're making sure that we're starting just prior to the Great Recession, so we don't have the distortion of the contraction and then the recovery inside of our numbers. And what we want to know is, given before the Great Recession and now well after the Great Recession, how is Iowa doing? How is it doing compared to the nation? How are specific industries doing in Iowa, again, compared to how those industries might be doing nationally? And then another part of this is then, how is the metropolitan economy in Iowa performing relative to the non-metropolitan economy? So those were the major breakdowns that I paid attention to when I did this study. The idea of it, though, is to help people understand, to give economic growth and change in Iowa some context. You know, you can sit in Des Moines or you can sit in Iowa City and you can look around and say, boy, this really looks good. Everything's great. Mm. But we have parts of the economy and parts of the state of Iowa that don't look so hot. So what I needed to do is help draw some of that out in this study.
Right. Talk about some of that unevenness, right, in Polk or Dallas County or Johnson County. You think everything's just honky-dory. Not so, right?
Not so. The metropolitan economy, given the time period before the Great Recession up through 2018, grew by about 9.3%, so relatively strong growth. The non-metropolitan part of the state's economy, it declined by 2%. And so it never recovered back to where it was prior to the Great Recession. And as a matter of fact, employment in the non-metropolitan part of the economy has started to flag a little bit. It's tailing off. And we know that two-thirds of the state's counties have continued to lose population. And so we have, you know, these twin things, a decline in economic vibrancy and a decline in demographic vibrancy going on at the same time. I want to move back to the metropolitan areas, mm-hmm. though. When we look at them in the aggregate, they look really strong. But only four of the metropolitan areas are growing more rapidly than the state average. That's Ames, Des Moines, Iowa City, and Dubuque. Hmm. The rest, the other four metropolitan areas that are in this comparison, which are going to be Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Council Bluffs, and Sioux City, are growing more slowly than the state average. So even within the metropolitan economy, we have really strong growth in some aspects of it, and then somewhat lackluster growth in other parts of the metropolitan economy.
Did you look at how Iowa's economy compares with other Midwestern states?
I did, and Iowa's very, very disappointing performance in that regard. Over the course of this last decade, Iowa ranked sixth worst nationally in growth. And if I just compare 2018 growth with any year prior to 2018, the average of all of those rankings for the state of Iowa was 46th. So we're not performing very well. Iowa ranked worst compared to all of its neighbors, just edged out Nebraska right. and Missouri, but it still ranked worst, and it ranked worst among all of the Plains states. So Iowa is a slow, economically performing state as measured by job growth.
Right. Is that anything? I mean, I don't know if you looked at this in your study. Why is that? Is that something something about Iowa we can't change, or is something about our policies we could have had differently?
Yeah, I did a calculation, and we do it. It's called a shift share analysis. And the idea of the shift share analysis is to figure out what are the components that explain growth. First of all, Iowa is composed of some industries that are important to Iowa, but they're not growing, or in fact, they're actually declining over time. And that's most notably, that's going to be agriculture, and that's going to be manufacturing. So if your portfolio is already loaded up with an underperforming in terms of job growth, yeah. you're not going to grow as fast as the rest of the nation. So that explained about 20% of the difference in our growth relative to the national rate of growth over this time period. The other 80%, though, is just simply the fact that even among those industries that are growing nationally and are growing here in Iowa, we're growing at a slower rate. Now, is that accentuated by a slow population growth, and does that explain part of it, or does slow job growth explain the lackluster growth in population? You know, those two things is very, very hard to tease out, but the fact remains that you know, four-fifths of what's going on in the state of Iowa is just an underperformance across a wide range of sectors.
Right. Your study says Iowa suffered its worst job losses in durable goods manufacturing, information industries, retail trade. But you also, as we come toward the end of this conversation, it's nice to have a little bright note. There were areas that Iowa performed best. In fact, compared to the nation, what outperformed the nation?
Well, we did relatively well in real estate, rental, and leasing. That actually led the state in terms of the number of jobs. We went through the housing bubble. A lot of things that were intended to be sold as houses ended up being apartments and condominiums. As well, that also involves ag land. Strong growth in ag services. We had close to national average growth in professional and scientific services and finance and banking. And then we had reasonably strong growth in what's classified as management of companies and enterprises. Well, that's not a large sector of the state's economy. It still nonetheless really outgrew the national rate of growth. I want to point this out. We had really strong losses in the information category. That includes newspapers, radio, TV, those types of employees. Mm. But it also includes digital hosting, data centers, and other kinds of higher tech. And we had very, very strong losses in the number of those jobs in the state.
Dave, in closing, fascinating work on your study, by the way. But in closing, we also had this week the president give his State of the Union address. I was interested in closing in your reaction to the president's characterization of our U.S. economy. Also, since you looked at in this study, you know, in the last decade, actually a little bit more to include the start of the Great Recession. His characterization of our U.S. economy and the difference his 3 years as president have made.
Well, the U.S. economy has had consistent job growth since we came out of the trough of the recession. And so job growth has been very, very consistent all the way through this time period.
Starting when?
We're really starting towards the end of 2010 into 2011. The national economy is starting to grow at a consistent rate. And as it continued to grow, jobs were recovered at a relatively consistent pace, something like 200,000 or so jobs each month are being added to the national economy. So that's what's been going on over the course of the last 3 years. It was also what was going on over the course of the 3 years that preceded it, roughly the same rate of growth. In fact, the 3 years preceding the current presidency was a little bit higher in terms of growth. Real gross domestic product, another measure of the strength of the economy, has also been growing at a relatively consistent pace over this period of time. You can't put a dot on that trend line and say this is where Obama ended and where Trump began. So if we look at these large fundamentals, the economy is basically performing currently very, very much like it's performed over the course of the entire last decade, over the recovery period of the last decade.
And you'd agree that's in a bit of a contrast to the way the president portrayed it.
Yes, he used superlatives that I don't think that I would have used.
All right. We'll leave it there. Dave Swenson, economist at Iowa State University. Thanks for a look at your study at Iowa's economy, growth over the past decade, the sectors that have poorly performed and a few that have overperformed. Dave Swenson, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
As we finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River, after 5 years as their live mascot, Drake University's very good boy has announced his retirement. The English Bulldog Griff, who has served as Drake's inaugural live mascot since October of 2015, will step down this summer, June 30th, after he's attended thousands of campus events. Perhaps you've even met Griff. He's met all of this year's presidential hopefuls who've been campaigning in Iowa. Now, the former champion show dog's future plans include, okay, you can guess, napping in his favorite chair. Joining us to talk about Griff's legacy, future plans for the live mascot program is Aaron Bell, associate marketing director in charge of the live mascot program at Drake University. Hey, Aaron, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
So we have a few minutes. Tell us, why did you feel like now was the time for Griff to step back from his official duties?
You know, I didn't want to wait until he started to have failing health or show signs of slowing down at all. I wanted him to go out at the top of his game, and I am really fortunate to be able to retire him at what I believe is just the perfect time.
Okay.
He'll be 8 years old in May, and Bulldogs don't have the longest life expectancy usually. We expect Bulldogs to live, 10 to 12 years. Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less.
Right.
And fortunately, Griff is very healthy, and we expect a few years at home with us.
Well, that's great. Now, can you tell us who will succeed Griff? There will be another live mascot at Drake, right? A bulldog?
Yes, there will be another live mascot at Drake for sure. There will be no break in the transition. It'll be, Griff will retire on June 30th, and Griff 2 will start his or her duties on July 1st.
Her duties. We know who it is.
His or her.
His or her. Okay, it was the phone line. I thought I was going to get a news flash out of that. Drake is not saying yet which dog this is, right?
We are not ready to announce quite yet, but I promise that an announcement will be made sooner rather than later.
Okay. You said living up to his duties, I think. What are the duties of the live mascot at Drake?
Oh, my gosh. Griff is everywhere. He is representing Drake University on all fronts. He does a lot with admissions and recruiting future Bulldogs. He does a lot with athletics. We're at the football games, all the men's and women's basketball games, and then we make it to all the other sports at some point as well. A lot with student organizations, alumni relations. Griff is just an integral part of this university, and he is everywhere.
Perhaps it's the phone line again. Did you say part of his duties was recruiting future Bulldogs?
Definitely, yeah. The admissions office uses him a lot, yep.
How does a Bulldog recruit other Bulldogs?
Well, in the admissions office. So we are there every Friday and greeting families that are visiting with prospective students.
Okay, I got it. The bulldog is recruiting human bulldogs. Very good. Okay. What will Griff be doing for the next 4 months until his official retirement?
He is on a celebration tour. We're going to be having a lot of events for his celebrating his retirement, and he will also continue all of his duties as normal.
Mm-hmm. I looked online, all over online, to see if Griff makes any noises. There are a lot of YouTube videos. He doesn't seem to. Doesn't he bark or make a slobbering sound or something?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of noises that come from Griff. He doesn't bark very much at all. Once in a great while, he will bark. But there's a lot of grunting, and we call them monster noises.
Monster noises.
Kind of a,
I like
kind
that.
Of a mood where he's, where he's kind of surly and sassy. But, yeah, he has a lot of slurping noises. Bulldogs are not quiet, that's for sure.
Okay, Aaron Bell, thanks for sharing with us. Associate Marketing Director in charge of the Live Mascot Program at Drake University, telling us about the announcement that Drake University's very good boy, Griff, had announced his retirement. Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us on.
All that we have left to do is to groove us into the weekend. Tony Daner is here from Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben. Glad to be back.
Yeah, we have had.
Oh, man.
We are glad to be back in the saddle or in the routine here for sure. Tell us, you've got a couple lined up. Anything dog worthy or human worthy or?
Well, let's stay in the animal realm for just a second.
Okay.
A new album from Squirrel Flower.
Oh.
This is the project of Ella Williams, who is a Boston native but a recent graduate of Grinnell College. And she just put out this record called I Was Born Swimming. It is her first for Polyvinyl, which is kind of a big indie rock label. And this is Slapback from Squirrel Flower.
I don't know what I could do if not this. And I think of you all the way back. You could tell me that my smile is diamonds, and then you could take it all back. I don't know what I could do if not this, and I think of you all the way back. You could tell me that my body is sacred, and then you could take.
I like that. Tell us again, Tony, what is the Iowa connection there with Squirrel Flower?
She is a recent graduate of Grinnell College.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got another perhaps animal-relevant tune for us
I promise you it just turned out this way. We're going to hear from Wolf Parade now, a little more distant relative of Griff, perhaps, with a new album. It's called Thin Mind. I really like this record. I was listening to it the other day and rocking out in my office. This is the song that gets this new Wolf Parade album started. It is called Under Glass.
Like science fiction. Under the glass again, and now I can't remember how life was outside, on the outside, yeah. They pull you one way, they push you back again. I know the soul division, poisoning my soul.
I love it. Wolf Parade. Tony Daner, thanks for introducing us to that Under Glass from Wolf Parade. We'll go out on that tune after I thank you, Tony Daner, and remind our listeners you can hear your daily soundtrack from Iowa Public Radio's Studio One 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. The best new music, old favorites, indie, singer-songwriter, blues, regional music. You've got it all there with Tony Daner and
sure
his
do.
Colleagues. Tony, thanks for joining us and for grooving us into the weekend.
Absolutely, Ben. Thank you. It's always okay to take a break and enjoy some great music.
All right. You have a great weekend, Tony.
You too, Ben.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Let's Wolf Parade out of this hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.